Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and welcome to the program. Once again, I'm joined by my most excellent panel from the City of Angels, well-known and well-respected attorney, Peter Haven. Peter, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. It's a pleasure to tackle the issues of the day yet again.
Are you digging out from any snow and stuff?
It's very interesting. I'm looking at all these football games back east, and every one of them is covered in snow. We had heavy rainfall here in Southern California, and it's been unusually cold, but no snow. No snow that I'm aware of.
In fact, I do a regular Tuesday deal with my good friend TJ Hart. He runs a talk radio program out of Bloomington, Illinois. And Thursday, I just couldn't help myself. It was 78 degrees here, and I looked on the weather map. It was 23 degrees in Bloomington, so I called into his show to share that information with him, and he basically growled at me.
He didn't appreciate that.
Right. And also joining us today is my very good friend, Bill Conrad. Bill, you're in New Jersey. Have you had the brunt of the weather yet, or are you still waiting for it to arrive?
I just looked out my window, and there is a light flurries coming down. We're supposed to get 1 to 3 inches here, and it's supposed to turn to rain by tomorrow. So hopefully we're not going to get any of those ice storms like the middle of the United States got.
Right. Ugly stuff. I want to start with a couple of stories, both of which I get a chuckle out of, but also I see as being somewhat serious. The gay divorce case out of Mississippi, my state. Here's the deal. Mississippi doesn't recognize gay marriage, so these two ladies hightail it to California, where they get married. They're very happy. Unfortunately, a year later, things aren't quite as rosy. So ladies want to get a divorce. There's a twist in this story. One of the ladies has decided that she doesn't want to be a lesbian anymore. Right? She wants to go with men. Peter, I know I sent you the news article about it. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's an interesting problem because right now, each state has the right at present to decide if it's going to recognize a gay marriage. And by the same token, it appears that what this article highlights is an issue of gay divorce, which is probably equally as important as dealing with gay marriage. The two are basically, in my opinion, one and the same. And in states like Mississippi, that apparently do not recognize gay marriage. That means if a couple gets married in another state and moves to Mississippi, and they live there and have property there during the marital union, then there's a problem with what happens if they want to get a divorce. And the short answer is that in states like Mississippi, it doesn't appear that the courts will really handle their divorce. So they have to consider other ways to deal with the divorce issues, any issues of alimony, any issues of division of community property. And that's what this article really highlights. I personally think that that this patchwork system is probably going to exist for a while until the Supreme Court addresses the issue and basically just says that states are going to have to recognize gay marriage and therefore gay divorce, and that laws that prevent that from happening now that are on the books in states, I suspect will be declared unconstitutional. And I don't know when that's likely to happen, but probably in the next, 5 to 10 years is a very conservative estimate. But until then, we're going to be engaged in a kind of patchwork quilt of different states with different rules.
I find it interesting. In some ways, this divorce case brings to the forefront the whole gay marriage issue. These two young, well, I don't know if they're young. I don't even know their names. They've split up, and one of them apparently is now an ex-lesbian. So here's my real question. Mississippi doesn't want to mess with it because Mississippi doesn't recognize gay marriage. So what happens if, Jane Doe decides that she wants to marry this guy, but there's, as far as I can see, nothing to stop her getting a valid, wedding license. But what happens next? If the couple were to move to, say, California, where the original two gals got married, is Jane Doe, a bigamist?
Well, I think that if she wants to get married in California, I think she has to also get a divorce in California. And I'm not familiar with how marriage licenses work and things like that, but it seems to me in order to get the marriage license in California,
Sorry, I didn't explain it. She gets married in Mississippi.
Married to a new spouse in Mississippi.
Someone of the male persuasion.
Well, a new spouse. It doesn't matter who. She wants to get married to a new spouse in Mississippi. Mississippi, as I understand it, does not recognize her first marriage. So she's not committing bigamy in the eyes of Mississippi by marrying a second time, because Mississippi doesn't recognize the first marriage, at least as far as the books on that the statute that I saw in the article indicated, that it doesn't recognize same-sex union. So she's
right.
Not going to be guilty of any polygamy laws in Mississippi. And I have doubts about whether or not if she moved to another state or was in another state, I doubt anybody would enforce those laws against her. But in theory, if she didn't complete the divorce the first time with the first marriage in however way she has to do it, presumably by going back to the state where they got married and getting a divorce there, if she didn't do that, then there are laws on the books somewhere where somebody, if they wanted to, might want to cite her or charge her with the offense of bigamy if they wanted to do that. And I just don't think anybody's going to want to do that. But in theory, it's possible.
Well,
now, well, and aren't there – well, I got a question. I mean, don't you run into all kinds of other problems with say, for instance, maybe one of them dies. Well, in certain states, she's still married to her. And now, when it comes to dividing the estate, doesn't that get all kinds of messy issues with the will and having other family people can test it? Don't you have problems with health insurance and even tax liability? Aren't there all kinds of messy things because it's recognized in one state and not another? And, you know, you move to a state in which their marriage is considered to still be on the books. Aren't there a whole bunch of other questions you have to ask?
There are other questions that have to be asked. I'm not sure how complicated they're going to be. You know, the issue of estate planning and what happens upon death of one's spouse is really, it's a function of two or three different things. And one is the laws of the state in which the person resided, because where they resided, which is presumably where they pass away, that's typically the law of the state that governs the disposition of their estate. Secondly, it also matters how big an estate they have. You know, if you're talking about some multimillionaire with properties and all of this and bank accounts and all of this, then that's something that could get very complicated. But typically, when we're talking about people passing on, the primary asset that first comes into play is the home. And, you know, the home is obviously going to be governed by the law of the state in which the home is located. And if the person who passes away has a home in Mississippi, then this isn't going to be an issue because Mississippi doesn't recognize this marriage. So if the person passes away in Mississippi, the home and the person's estate will proceed in whatever way that person has set up their estate to be disposed of. And I suppose a person who felt that they were a spouse of the person who died in Mississippi, they might try to file in the state of where they reside to see if they could get some sort of relief, but I just don't think that would be very effective. The property and the decedent's estate are located in, for example, Mississippi, and that's where it's all going to be resolved.
All right. Now, right at the beginning of the program, you said something very interesting. This isn't going to get resolved until the Supreme Court gets involved. Personally, I think this issue is going to percolate up the chain. It may not be this, you know, particular couple in Mississippi, but Peter, you've got to admit that there are so many questions here that at some point it is going to hit the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's what I said. I do believe it's going to be addressed by the Supreme Court. To me, from a legal perspective, this situation is analogous to basically the situation that the Supreme Court dealt with in regard to abortion and a woman's right to choose. For, you know, several decades, that was a hotly contested right, and it was a question of states' rights, and you had people who would go from one state to another to try to get abortions, and that gave rise to sort of black market. You know, in states where abortions were illegal, there were various black market kind of abortion, quote-unquote, clinics that arose, and you heard all these horror stories. So, you know, but that was the battleground amongst the respective states that permitted it, state legally permitted it, states that didn't legally permit it, and the complications that arose. And it took a while for that to basically percolate up to the Supreme Court and then get addressed. And I think that that's the same thing that's going to happen here with gay marriage. You see a number of states already enacting legislation saying that it is legal, that they do recognize same-sex marriages, and some states are still resisting. But to me, the writing seems on the wall. The writing is on the wall in that I think eventually a case will percolate to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in my opinion, won't really have much option. They could surprise us and say that each state still gets to decide and it's fundamental right and blah, blah, blah. But I think the more likely result is that they'll just say, look, you know, constitutionally speaking, you don't have the right not to recognize a same-sex union. That's what I think the Supreme Court should do, but we'll see what happens.
Bill, do you have any thoughts?
It's just so complicated. Again, if one state said it's one thing and another state says it's something else, it's not just, you know, you try to compare it to other things that aren't easily definable, like, you know, where do you, if you cross state lines, you have to keep moving your rifle. If you're a hunter, it needs to be in the trunk. It needs to be in a gun rack. It needs to be in various different places. And so every time you cross a state line, because you're a hunter, you have to move things around. And somehow I can't wrap my hands around, you know, what kind of legal problems you're going to get into because you crossed the state line after you've been gay and you married in one state. And, what happens with testimony? What if there's aren't there issues on how you can testify against your spouse? Because if you didn't get your divorce or annulment of your marriage, and you go into one of those other states now, legally, and your spouse committed a crime, you can't testify against her. It seems like there's a whole lot of issues that are going to need to be sorted out. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it.
Well, you're not oversimplifying. You're saying it's overly complicated, and the thing you raise about the testimonial privilege is interesting. And for people who don't know this, there are various, states have various privileges which attach to the marital relationship. And in certain circumstances, one spouse has the right to prevent another spouse from testifying against that spouse, for example, in a criminal proceeding. It's considered akin to talking to your lawyer or talking to a priest. It's supposed to be an extension of the privilege against self-incrimination, and in certain circumstances, you're basically deemed to be talking to yourself, such that we can't force that kind of testimony. But the simple solution to all of it is why I think the Supreme Court will do what it's going to do. It'll just say, look, you know, it's too much of a mess any other way, and the Constitution doesn't give states the right to prohibit or to not recognize a gay marriage between consenting adults. And for all these other reasons, the Constitution permits people to get married of the same sex, and that will be, in my opinion, as close as we get to a magic wand that waves it over and makes it all better. Otherwise, you're going to have all these crazy conflicting things popping up across the country.
Peter, you're the lawyer. I'm just the guy that reads stuff. I thought it was across all states that a spouse cannot be forced to testify against the husband or wife.
Well, every criminal law is a creature of each state. So each state has its own code of criminal law. It has its own code of evidence. And it is usually the case, I'm not familiar with every single state's evidence code and its criminal procedure and criminal law. In California, that privilege exists. I presume it exists in one form or another in every single state. States change their codes a little bit from one state to the next, but generally speaking, the theories are usually the same. Now, that's in state court, and most crimes are considered state court matters, you know, the ones we always think of. Someone gets killed, someone gets robbed, someone gets attacked. These are state court issues, and they get resolved under state court rules. Now, there's an overlaying court system called the federal court system, and that system exists in every state, and it stretches across the entire country, and there are multiple U.S. district courts in every state. And those courts have more or less a uniform body of rules and evidence. So if you end up in federal court on a white-collar crime or any kind of other criminal situation that subjects you to federal prosecution, then those privileges against self-incrimination are uniform and they attach throughout. And again, with states, I think every state has a similar prohibition against, a similar provision for spousal privileges, but I just don't know precisely what each state has, and there may be an anomaly. There may be one out there that doesn't, but I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Well, okay. As I said, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a reader. How is a case determined to be state or federal?
Well, typically it's not that hard. If we're just talking about the criminal law, every state has a vested interest in keeping law and order in its own state. And so usually anything that happens within the territorial confines of the state is almost always a state law criminal matter. If a citizen of a state is murdered, killed, attacked, robbed, beaten, fill in the blank. If a citizen of a state within the territory of the state is the victim of some type of crime, then that is almost always an exclusively state court jurisdiction matter. Now, that means that the state has a vested interest in resolving it and can take it to trial, et cetera. Now, if there's any kind of overlay which implicates any federal criminal law, for instance, it involved trafficking of weapons or something across state lines, or a good example of this would be the Boston bombings at the Marathon. When that happened, that was clearly a state court issue. It happened on Massachusetts soil. It happened in Boston, Boston citizens, Boston event. There may have been citizens from other parts of the country who were there who were also injured or killed, but it clearly fell within the confines of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and they had the right to prosecute that survivor and pursue that to get a conviction. There may also be federal laws, and I think there clearly were federal laws that were also violated in the course of engaging in that bombing. And so the federal government also has the right to prosecute that survivor. And usually what happens in those kinds of situations is that the state district attorney's office and the United States attorney, they usually try to work with each other, and either one prosecution gets to go first, or they decide that it's going to make more sense to go with one prosecution as opposed to another. But each one has the right to prosecute, and in theory, if they both wanted to prosecute and they couldn't reach some sort of an agreement, then one would get prosecuted and another would get prosecuted, and then there would be two prosecutions going on at the same time. But usually that's avoided. They work something out. And I think in Boston, it appears from what I gathered that they decided to go with the federal prosecution because I think they felt that, among other things, they had the right to pursue the death penalty under the federal laws. And I think under Massachusetts law, they didn't have the right to pursue the death penalty.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah, enough of this truly depressing stuff. Let's talk.
Welcome to my world.
Are we gonna go to the cake problem in Denver?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Here's the thumbnail sketch. There's a baker. There are two gay guys who want to get married, and they go to the baker. And they say to the baker, "Baker, baker, bake me a cake." And baker says, "Get the hell out of my establishment. I am not making you a cake." Now, we've all seen the signs in bars, restaurants, even 7-Elevens, you know, "No shirt." Yeah, no shoes, no service. Yeah, isn't it the right of the establishment to decide who they will or will not serve? Well, apparently not. In Denver, a judge has ordered the baker that unless he bakes cakes for gays, you know, he faces, at the very least, some fines. How do you feel about that, Peter?
As a general rule, it is true that a private business has the right to refuse service to anyone. The Constitution, as it's written, only applies to the government. It does not apply to private citizens. So a business is a private citizen, and so generally speaking, it can refuse service to anyone for any reason. It gets more complicated if the business is receiving some sort of government assistance, or if the business is located in certain zones of commerce, and one of the conditions of operating in these, you know, zoned commerce areas is they can't discriminate. You know, it's difficult to be an island in the world. You can't just separate yourself from the government. So even though a private citizen is free to discriminate, and is not, the Constitution doesn't prohibit that, the role of government in our culture is such that it usually, you can't just remain completely private. You usually have to cross some governmental boundary in some point, in some manner. And frequently you're getting some measure of government assistance. And I don't know what the particular facts and circumstances are here, but the district court appeared to have some basis for requiring this guy to accommodate this request. And rather than order the person to actually bake the cake, what I heard you say is that the district judge said if they don't, they're going to face fines, penalties, what have you. But I don't know precisely what those legal rulings were, but in my opinion, it has to do something with what I've talked about. For whatever reason, this bakery isn't prohibited. It is prohibited from discriminating against people, and so if it violates that prohibition, there are consequences. And I just don't know enough about it to say more than that.
I do believe that we have the infamous Sam Moffey on the line now.
Oh, it's Moffey time.
And I want to tell you, it appears the Browns are upsetting the incredibly great, wonderful New England Patriots. Of course, they were up by 12 before I called with about a minute to go. That is amazing to me.
Well, I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, well, I'm here. I took the Browns today and got 11.5, so I'm very happy to hear.
Before we get into the main event, I just have one more question for Peter. Peter, you managed to skillfully avoid one of the one of the things I said. You know, this is a private company. Don't they have a right to decline sales?
Well, I guess I didn't skillfully evade that since you caught me at it, or I thought I answered it. I thought I did say that the general rule is that a private citizens, a private business has the right to refuse service to anyone, and that, but there are exceptions to those rules when, for example, you're getting any kind of government assistance or you are operating in some zone or sector of the municipality that part of being there subjects you to other rules and regulations, including those against discrimination. Those are just two, but I don't know all of them, and I don't know why the exception is in this case, but I'm obviously that's one of those exceptions. It's very hard to remain in Ireland.
The reason that the gay couple were turned away was the baker claimed that making this cake would go against his principles of religion. Does that make a difference?
And here's what it is. I pulled this article up. It certainly. You can imagine the First Amendment, which provides for freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And, there's a reason it's the First Amendment. It's one of the important ones on which a democracy is founded. But you can imagine how difficult it is to deal with the freedom of religion, because what could be justified or excused in the name of religion is immeasurable. I mean, we see terrorist acts every day that are made in the name of religion. There are people who worship the devil, and they believe that they have a right to worship the devil, even if that calls for sacrificing animals or, God forbid, sacrificing people. And it goes on and on and on. And I took an entire course in law school on dealing with the complexities and the difficulties of the freedom of religion in a modern democracy. And, the long and the short of it is we could take a month to analyze all these cases and the different patchwork of legal problems that it creates. And at the end of the day, what you're left with is essentially courts have to interpret they have to subject freedom of religion to rules of reason. You can't, if freedom of religion doesn't just give you the right to do whatever you want and then simply put a bumper sticker on it and say, well, that's my religion. And that's what happened here. The baker said, no way, it offends my religion. Now, I believe that the baker probably was offended by this and that it probably did offend his religion. He's probably a member of a religion that considers this blasphemy. But that religious belief, this district court judge found, that religious belief was not sufficient under these circumstances to warrant an exception to the situation. And the exception was that Colorado has a comprehensive anti-discrimination law which prohibits discrimination in public accommodation on the basis of sexual orientation or gender, et cetera. And, you can imagine that, for instance, hotels and restaurants in Colorado are subject to a general law that says you can't discriminate against people based on these particular character traits. You can discriminate against them because they didn't wear a shoes or shirt or they dressed funny or they were smelly or what have you. But if it's found that you're discriminating them based on one of these protected classifications, then under Colorado law, and I suspect there are similar laws in every state, that is impermissible. So what the judge did is he basically balanced the two. He said, okay, you have a right to religious worship or expression, but we have there's a comprehensive law on the books in Colorado that the citizens of Colorado have passed, and I have to weigh the two. And when I weigh the two, I find that your reason just simply isn't compelling enough to violate the Colorado statute. And, you know, to me, that's a pretty easy call for a judge on these facts. I don't know what it would be if it was a different factual situation. But on these facts, that's a pretty easy decision.
Well, Peter, can I make a comment? I follow all your line of reason, but again, the way I look at this is that they walk into a bakery. They had the ability to buy a cake off of the shelf. They had the ability to buy a loaf of Italian bread. They could buy cookies and everything else. There was never a discrimination about them buying anything from the bakery. They're asking for a custom-made product. So I would think that the rights of anyone who owns a small business to do something that is custom, they should have the final say in whether or not they want to do that, or whether they have the ability to do that, or it seems like it's the right thing for them to do according to their conscience. I think that's the biggest part about this.
Well,
is that wrong?
No, I don't think it's wrong, but I think that when you operate a business in Colorado that has a state that has a general anti-discrimination law that applies to businesses like this, that it's on the books that you can't – that if you refuse to provide a service to one customer – that you would provide to another customer, and the refusal to provide it is based on the one customer's membership in a protected classification, in this case, sexual orientation, then you have violated the Colorado anti-discrimination statute. Now, people often call me, and they always say the same question. Can they do that? Can we make them do that? Do they have to do that? And it's always a different question of the same refrain I hear over and over again. Can they do that? Can they do that? And I always tell people the same answer. People everywhere, all over the world, can do whatever they want. They can make any choice they want, but they have to live with the consequences of their choices. It's not a question of making people do something. It's a question of imposing a consequence on them if they do choose. And this bakery owner chose to violate the Colorado statute. If that's important enough to him and he wants to violate that statute, he is free to do so. But he must suffer the consequences, whatever those consequences are. And maybe the consequences are just fines. Maybe he can be subjected to a lawsuit for damages. And a business owner who opens up his shop to the public, who hangs at his shingle and says, come in public, in state like Colorado and probably in many other states, if you're going to operate that kind of business, you got to operate under Colorado laws. And if you choose to disregard those laws, there's going to be a consequence. And, you know, this is another version of the same thing. You know, we talked about Snowden a week ago. Snowden operated under a code of conduct, and he was obligated to comply with that code of conduct. And if he didn't, for whatever ideological reason that he felt compelled not to, he was going to be subjected to the consequences. And, you know, it's the same version a thousand ways over. The best example I can think of is every state makes it a felony punishable, a capital crime to commit murder. Happens in every state, every day. People still commit murders. You can put whatever law on the books you want. People either are or are not going to comply with it, but there's a consequence for breaking the law.
Okay. I want to bring Sam in on this one. You know,
that's probably a good segue.
Right. You know, Sam, I walk into your establishment, I order some wings, and I say to you, these suck. Yes, these are the worst wings I've ever had. And
I make a ruckus, I leave, you know, and a week later, I come in, and you say, Simon, you can just get your ass out of my establishment.
My attitude is, I've heard most of the conversation. It's been excellent. To me, the baker is like selectively enforcing who he decides to, serve the cake to. Bill, you brought up a great point. Hey, it's a special order. But, you know, why would, unless he's trying to get some Chick-fil-A type attention, and I say that because if you remember last year, or you remember the year before that, the owner of Chick-fil-A is very, very anti-homosexual and all that stuff and makes a comment, and people protested, and then there was an anti-homosexual crowd who protested his place. You know, they all say, hey, let's go to Chick-fil-A to make big money there. And there was a Chick-fil-A sales actually spiked that one day when it was supposed to be, to go there. But you know, maybe that's what the baker was trying to hope for. I don't know. But the situation is I consider not serving anybody in today's world unless they come in, no shoes, I'm just filthy, disgusting, reeking, or are obviously so trash that you could be held liable for anything they may not do, or to me if they're carrying a weapon. I don't let them in, and I wouldn't serve them. But as far as sexual orientation, race, color, creed, whatnot, age, as long as they're over 21, they can come in. That's the law, that you would serve them. It's mind-boggling to me that in today's world, for 2013, anybody would be turned down for sexual orientation. And I just, can't see. Like I said, it's mind-boggling to me. Why you wouldn't do that? Unless you have an ulterior motive of trying to get yourself a lot of extra attention like the Chick-fil-A people did. They're hoping that they're going to get, all these anti-gay people are going to come running there and order cakes online from the guy. Homophobes. That's what I see.
Oh, okay. Now, I think it's time to get to the meat and potatoes. Sam, would you care to explain the coconut grove?
The coconut grove issue. I don't know if I'll have enough time in an hour to do this, but I'll do my best. I hope I don't bore anybody to death. The Coconut Grove is the second oldest liquor establishment after Prohibition in Mahoning County was founded. It's been around for that long. It was purchased by my mother and stepfather in the year 1999, and we ran it due to the background. It was in a neighborhood. When it was open in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and in the 80s, it was the place to be. In Youngstown was a wet town. That means that it had liquor, and all the surrounding suburbs did not. So it didn't. Anybody with an outhouse with a liquor license in Youngstown made money because the people from the suburbs came in and did the drinking and eating. The Coconut Grove was known for all sorts of good food and whatnot, and did a very good business. Unfortunately, the Coconut Grove became a prisoner of its own zip code, and as the neighborhood changed. We changed the bar to the best of our ability, but became the neighborhood became more and more violent. It became less owner occupied. The white flight took place. All those things that you've ever seen took place, but the bar was still there, still been a fixture. And across the street from us, I have this couple that is the, does anybody know, are people familiar with Block Watches? Are my three ex-panelists familiar with Block Watch?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Peter?
Well, that's just another version of that guy down in Florida, right?
Zimmerman.
I mean, he's the neighborhood watch.
Right, neighborhood watch, right. Okay, the block, we call them block watches up here. The block watch in Youngstown, the people who ride across the street, have this enormous power in their little in the area for some reason, because they're the eyes and ears of the council person. So if the block watch person doesn't like a location or a person or a building, they wield their power in a way of, like, for instance, my block watch guy's name is Bob Gray, and he's right across, and he hates the fact that, matter of fact, he testified, and I'll get into this in a second, but he constantly was calling the police department over the last 10 years over anything he saw wrong at the Coconut Grove. He sat there on his porch with binoculars and filming anything that went on there, looking at anything that went on there, and would constantly call 911 and constantly call the councilman to get action there. And, of course, the councilman never got my side of the story or anybody else's side of the story, and not just in my location, but in other locations around in his ward. So it's that old saying in democracy at a local level, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So if he called up the police would just show up there to pacify him, but they'd have to write up a report. The councilman never wanted to get my point of view or anybody else's point of view. He just always assumed that this guy was telling the truth, because he put a yard sign up. He might have donated $10 to his campaign, maybe put a couple other yards. He was his political eyes and ears, his pulse on the ground, allowing the councilman not to do his job. Councilman relied on Bob Gray to do his job, and other ones in every aspect of his ward. It makes him no different than any other councilman. Anyway, as the neighborhood changed, it got rougher and rougher in the neighborhood. We still turned a profit, a good profit there, because I ran a good place. I had some good, the bar got more, became a 50-50 bar. What I meant was 50% African Americans, 50% white people going there. They enjoyed the food. They enjoyed it. We had the best pool table. One of the things that kept, we had pool leagues and a dart league, and we were the only ones on the side of the town who had night pool tables. And a lot of people came to shoot the pool and do all that. Over there, we had really good food. We didn't serve wings there, a fried food. It was real. We had steak fries, chicken, you know, all sorts, big different sort of things to keep people going there. And because it's been around a long time, there was a lot of loyal customers who would come around. All right. Neighborhood changed, and what happens, and then the city of Youngstown, in the year 2011, there is a gentleman by the name of Jerome Miller, 19-year-old kid, 3 months before the date of late October of 2011, his brother is assassinated. He's a member of a gang. His brother is assassinated in another part of town. There's a baby in the house. The people who assassinated his brother stuck the baby on top in a pool of blood, of the father's pool of blood, and sat the baby there. Okay? Jerome, this is according to media reports, swore vengeance. Just right out of a movie, guys, okay? Well, Jerome, 3 months later, every night, at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, whatnot, he would go to the Coconut. He was 19 years old. He never drank. He would order food to go. He always did that. And on this late day in October of 2011, he decides to get some food. He comes out. He's walking. The Coconut Grove was on the corner of Lucius Avenue and South Avenue in Youngstown. There's a large parking lot. Three vacant lots around us that used to have houses that have been torn down, and it's a huge apron from to get on Lucius Avenue or South Avenue into the parking lot. He's bent down on the apron, or one could say sidewalk, near the bar by the people that he, and that crime is still unsolved as of today. In December 27th, 2011, the city of Youngstown has a council meeting after they've had other meetings and voted not to reject, have the state not renew my liquor license. A month after that, I got a certified letter in the mail from the state saying I have to go to a hearing, that I had no idea these hearings were going, meetings were going on with the city of Youngstown. We had no idea that they were objecting to our license until no one called me, no one gave us any forewarning, no one allowed us to mount our own defense, whatever. It just happened. We had to wait 5 months to get a hearing date that would fit everybody's schedule. My attorney at the time, the attorney hired by my parents, myself, the councilmen, the people, everybody. It took 5 months to get the hearing. Meanwhile, we were allowed to operate pending this hearing. The hearing took place in May of 2012, and the two police officers came in to testify. One was the vice squad, detective investigating the murder of Jerome Miller, who testified about the murder, basically told you what I just told you. Another one was a police dispatcher who came in with 3 years of police records and phone calls made to the Coconut Grove, of which 56 phone calls were made, of which one of them, for instance, was from this guy, Bob Gray, who I told you about. He did not like the way the plow guy pushed the snow into the street. That was a 911 call made. So there were 56 phone calls that this police dispatcher testified to, one by one. There was the detective about the unsolved murder. Bob Gray testified that he didn't like the fact that the bar, in his own words, the bar, it's different now than it was in 1950. In 1950, it was whiter around here. Those are direct quotes from him. The councilman testified and said that said all sorts of political bullshit but said nothing. And then I got to testify and told them what was going on. I testified that the murder was unsolved. We had nothing to do with it. The 56 phone calls, in a short period of time, I sliced and diced three quarters of them as bullshit. And I also pointed out that other bars and other locations in the city have had murders. For instance, there were two murders the month before Mr. Miller was assassinated at a church called St. Dominic's. I said, why aren't you shutting down the church? I mean, if the bar is responsible for the murder, then isn't the church responsible for its murder? They happened right in the church's parking lot. As a matter of fact, the guy, the person who killed the two people at the churches, they knew the people going in there to worship. They came out, they shot him. They knew they had money. Mine was an assassination, from what we've been able to piece together. And would assassinate them anywhere. They just happened to pick that. And I pay taxes. I'm a citizen. I have a building there. We pay taxes. We have five employees. We're all paying into the system. How come we're not treated? Why are we victims of this, too? We're victims of the crime, too. We didn't do it. We're victims, too. We deserve the same sort of police protection. You can't blame the murder on me because you can't link it to me or anybody at the bar. The bar has not caused any problems. We're not the only part of town that's had crime. In this neighborhood alone, there's been 5,000 police calls made. You know, it's a bad part of town. We should be working together, not singling me out and saying, if this problem, we shut this bar down, all our crime's going to go away. There'll be no more murders. There'll be no more rapes. There'll be no more killing. There'll be no more drug dealing. There'll be no more anything. How can you say that that's what's going to happen if you shut it down without making a connection to me or anybody who works in the bar?
I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment.
Thanks, I can catch my breath.
Right. Peter, what are your thoughts on the story so far?
Well, my first thought is, Sam, I'm very sorry, but the Browns did manage to lose that game.
Oh, you're kidding.
While you were going off, I saw the last second highlights, and they fumbled in their own end zone, and a few plays later, New England scored, and that's how it ended. So,
they could. I called them, they were up by 12 with a minute to go.
They snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, as usual. Secondly, I'm very proud of you in terms of you know, from a legal perspective, I thought your arguments were very compelling, and I think it is, you know, that you've done now what we as lawyers have to do all the time. You know, half of our job is factual investigation. The other half is legal analysis. But you've investigated the facts because they're important to you. And what you're uncovering is that facts appear to be one thing on the surface, but when you dig deeper, they're very different. You know, 50-some-odd incidents is one thing, but many of them may or may not have to do with violent behavior, and similar incidents are occurring elsewhere. I especially liked the point you had to make about the fact that it was appeared to be an assassination-style killing and not caused by the environment per se. I found your arguments very persuasive or very compelling. So, you know, I hope you get your fair day in court, and there's a full process to hear all these things without having these things decided in, you know, something like a star chamber kind of environment. And it sounds like you're on your way, so kudos to you. You know, hopefully you'll have your day in court, and when that happens, you'll be able to bring all this evidence to light, and then hopefully a judge will rule, and he'll be more fair and impartial than some of these hearings sometimes are, and if that's not the case, you always have the right to appeal as well. And that's what the court systems are for. They're to try to work out these kinds of problems.
And Bill, I know that you're not or weren't privy to any of this information. What are your thoughts off the top of your head?
Well, while he was talking, I popped over to get a news report about this. There is one listed on the internet, so he's had a wide media coverage on this whole incident. it kind of is what it is, and you know, I feel really bad that Sam has gotten caught up into the way these neighborhoods are changed, and you know, there obviously seems to me to be some kind of a hidden agenda to do something with that property other than what it's being used for now. That's just my gut feeling on it, but that's again, that's all conjecture on my part. So, because usually that's when you see these things happen in these changing neighborhoods, they find a reason to shut down a place because there's ultimate plans for something else there. I wish Sam luck again with being able to fight this and win.
Sam, okay, I'm sorry I interrupted your wonderful
first of all, I didn't want to hear what Peter had to say about the Browns. That's pathetic, but it's fitting for you know what they call it? We're starting to call it the death factory or something like that. They call it like that up the street from the death factory. But anyway, you know, it gets better, gang. It gets better. Peter, thank you for the compliment. Comes from experience and asking the right people the right questions on how to dig. And I thank you for some of the advice you've given me, by the way.
I forgot to mention that you were arrested on my birthday, so that was interesting.
Is that your birthday?
Yes, it was.
Well, what happened, gang, I just went on, and the state, we went through this, my parents hired an attorney to represent, they wanted to keep the bar open, we were making money, et cetera, the value, recognizing that without the value, without the liquor license, income is going to, you know, disappear, the value of the property isn't what it's the same as with a liquor license, there's value to that above and beyond not having one. I may make the property worth more money. And we paid off the mortgage. There was no mortgage on the property, et cetera, over the years.
Nice.
So the next thing that happened was during the summer, while we were going back and forth and appealing, I continue to buy on behalf of the corporation in the state of Ohio, controls the liquor department. They tell you where you can go to buy liquor. We had to go to, it's geographically located. Every state liquor store has so many bars and restaurants that it can sell to because they all get a commission. So I always had to go to the same place. And I continued to go to that place and bought liquor on behalf of the Coconut Grove as needed, or a coworker did, or no, somebody else did it. And in August, the state, believe it or not, ruled back, said that they agreed with the city of Youngstown that they should, that our license was, that they were going to reject our license. Okay, so it blew us all away based upon how bad they handled the hearing, how well we did it. My attorney advised me, he goes, okay, the license expires in January 31st of 2013. If you want me to appeal it, then I'll be glad to. But if not, basically you can only operate until January 31st of 2013 because that they've rejected your license and that's when the license is, you know, that's when the license is up. We went by that attorney's ruling and it made sense to me. We went back and forth about appeals. The lawyer, my parents, spoke to the attorney. He wanted a lot of money. He had to go to Columbus, which is an hour and a half drive, and it's a bigger to do. And he put a couple letters in that he was gonna he wanted to get a stay of execution pending an appeal and things of nature like that, and go on to all that. Just throw all the usual legal stuff on the cheap into it. The lawyer, his name is David Beatrice, was also the head of the Mahoning County Democratic Party, okay, which is in Mahoning County, we have no Republican Party. So he is the man who runs the political establishment here for the Democratic Party. Thought we were in good hands because of that, and he has a reputation of being a fixer, so to speak, because of his political political, you know, his being a political animal. Well, on November 6th, meanwhile, that letter came on August 24th of 2011 that said you have to shut down, your stay of execution has been denied, your renewal has been denied. They set up a appeal in Columbus for December 6th of 2012. So we continued to operate thinking we would be out of business on February 1st if we lost the appeal or decided not to go with the appeal. Well, on November 6th election night, when my attorney is in counting votes for the presidential election, I get a call from a coworker at the Coconut Grove saying the police are in here taking everything out of here and they're shutting us down. So the smartest thing I did that night is take my wife with me because I knew I have a hot temper and I would have said something. We drove up to the Coconut Grove, and lo and behold, there were two uniformed police officers there, John Doe 1 and 2, and then John Doe 3 and 4. They represented from the Vice Squad, and that we have been operating illegally since August 24th when the city received a letter that, and we did too, that said we lost that hearing in May. And I said, but hey, but we have an appeal pending December 6th. And the Vice Squad guy got very hostile. I got hostile back. Luckily, my wife was there. So then I asked, can I see your search warrant? You're taking things out of here. You've seized stuff from my bar, my location, my premises. You're not allowed to do that without a search warrant. And I want to see the judge's order. They didn't have anything. They both, the Vice Squad guys huddled. They got on their cell phones. They came to me and said, the law director and the chief of police say, you've been operating illegally. I'll be right back. Meanwhile, he directed to his companion, continue to take inventory. And I went to say, you can't take inventory. And the cop said, you take one. And I went to go reach one of the bottles out. He said, you take one more. Let go of that. You're going to jail right now. And the other two uniformed cops came over, and they were all going to throw me in jail. Okay, so I said, okay, I'll wait to see the search warrant. So I figured they're all running around trying to find a search warrant and find some judge. They come back a half hour later. The John Doe, Vice Squad guy, comes back with the letter that I had received in August and says, this is my search warrant. And I said, that's not a search warrant. There's no judge signature on it. Where's the local judge? Where's the judge's signature? By the way, where's the Department of Liquor Control that has jurisdiction over the liquor? How are you guys operating without the state here at all? And they go, here's the letter. And if you make any more moves or say anything else, look at me courtside, you know, the usual, I'm throwing you in jail. So my wife took me out of there and I left. Finally got a hold of the attorney the next day after he was because he was celebrating Obama's victory. He said, I'm going to file a suit. I'll take care of it. Don't worry. You'll get everything back. You'll meet me in my office. I did all that. Well, while he was working on this suit, actually he took off for a day or two to celebrate Obama's victory and wouldn't be back in town until the following Monday. I was on Friday night after the election, was at my other location in Austintown, Bill's place. And 7:30 p.m., that John Doe 1 and 2, with John Doe 3, Vice Squad, came up to Austintown, demanded I sign a piece of paper that said that what they did was okay and this and that, and I had a court date. And I said, I'm not signing anything because what you did was illegal. If I sign this, that means saying everything you guys did 2-3 days ago was kosher. And it wasn't. So I'm not signing a damn thing. So, and by the way, where is the Austintown police? You're out of your jurisdiction. What are you doing here? Where is the, you know, how do you walk in here without the state? Because it's the liquor establishment. They have jurisdiction over it. And how do you walk in here without the Austintown police? This isn't your jurisdiction. And they cuffed me and took me down to the county jail and abused me the whole way down, verbally.
I have to admit that the idea of cuffing you and verbally abusing you, you know, has crossed my mind a couple of times. but you know, I don't think that's fair. Peter, what do you make of the story so far?
Well, it does sound like cops are behaving badly. You know, when you think about it, it sounds like they're out of control. And you're quite right. We have one of the things that Sam's pursuing is a Section 1983 claim, which is a claim that under color of authority, state officials abused constitutional rights, etc. So that's what this sounds like. And when you ask people for a search warrant and they show you a letter, you know, that's pretty egregious behavior. That's very egregious behavior. So I take it they will never be able to come up with a warrant for this. And it sounds like, Sam, you have some very viable claims. And I'm glad to hear this information, because the additional information that you provided now is, it leaps off the page, and it's not as persuasive when you just read the complaint as when you describe it like that. And that's why
I think
your testimony is going to be very powerful.
Well, thank you, Peter, and it gets better, believe it or not. So the attorney comes back who's been hired. He prepares a case to file in county court. And I sat with him and go, why are you going to county court? We should be filing in federal court. And he goes, no. He goes, remember, I'm the chairman of the Democratic Party. I've got pull. I've got this. I've got that. Okay, fine. I'm gonna defer to you, but I think we should be in federal court. Okay, but I'm not an attorney. I just got this gut feeling that we're, you know, he goes, don't worry about it. Well, we went in, and right away the magistrate was pro. It looked like he's an idiot or whatnot, but that's why he's a county court magistrate. And here's what I did. Remember, as I said, the Vice Squad officer said we've been operating illegally since August. Of course, it was November before they ever said anything. Again, no one says anything to us. No one sends us any communication. No, we're just someone to be beat up and abused. Like all other citizens, I guess. So that day on November 15th, when I went to court with the lawyer, and he was going to file a mandamus injunction, get us our stuff back, blah blah blah. An hour before court, I went down to it's called Gino's Drive Thru. That's with our state liquor control agency. I went to them and I go, "Can I purchase liquor from you on the Coconut Grove permit?" She made a phone call to go, "Your license is still valid." So I go, "I purchased a bottle of liquor, wholesale, okay? Not retail, wholesale." And I got a copy of the invoice, got it, and I brought it to court with me, thinking, "Oh, this is my Perry Mason moment." This should tell them that, because there's no way I could purchase that, or my lawyer wouldn't bring it up. And I started to think, is the fixing for me here? The politics is coming back to bite me in a different way. And what I did not know is that my stepfather had called up and had talked to the attorney, my stepfather decided not to file an appeal because the lawyer wanted another $15,000. I did not know that at the time. I was out doing some stuff. So this guy he had like no desire to represent me at this point because my stepfather wasn't going to give me or put up any money for the case. That got serious. I may be wrong on that, but I don't know why he didn't let me present this evidence, because we made a purchase. A week after that, I got a letter in the mail from the Department of Liquor Control that said, "We have lost the case." Now, this is bizarre, okay? This is from the Department of State Liquor Control that we have lost the case. It's called Bugs in the Bottle. Every summer, the Department of Liquor Control goes around to all the bars in Ohio, and they try to and they look at all the bottles that are sweet. You guys know what slow gin is? Gin fizzy. Do you ever have that stuff when you were kids?
Oh, yeah.
Or mixes. Okay, they look for mixes that have a sweet taste to it because gnats start to congregate around these bottles of mixes, of schnapps, of peppermint schnapps, another one. And they fine you $100. Okay, they take you to Columbus, they take you to court, and they make a big to-do about it, and you'll lose, you can't win, okay? And they make a fortune off it. It's a revenue stream for the Department of Liquor Control. Well, right after this hearing on the 15th, I received a letter from the state saying, "Dear Coconut Grove, your case was heard in front of us in October. 3 weeks ago, you have to pay a $100 fine or shut your bar down on November 28th, 29th, and 30th of this month. And you either pay money or you have to keep your door shut." So I look at this letter and I go, "Now, wait a minute. Here they're telling me the state had just said I'm open for business, that I lost the case for Bugs in the Bottle, and if I don't pay the $100 or shut down for 3 days in late November, they'll find me even more money. But the state is saying I'm legal. Why doesn't the city see me as being legal? Here's a document that says I'm legal in November. Okay, the state said the city's saying I was illegal in August. But yet I'm allowed to buy things. I'm allowed to do things. The liquor department themselves is allowing me to buy things." Well, to add insult to injury, 3 days before Christmas of last year, the Department of Liquor Control calls me up and says, "Hey, we have to, are you going to renew your liquor license for next year, which would have been 2015? I go, "No, we're not." And they go, "Well, there's 6 weeks left to go. I have to meet his name is Steve Arnold. I have to meet with you. You have to give me the old license, and I have to give you a receipt that effective the day you get this, we consider you closed and you can no longer buy liquor on the wholesale level." And that's what I did. So the state sent me a letter that says, as of December 28th of last year, we are no longer a viable entity to buy and sell liquor. They send a letter to all my distributors that said you cannot sell wholesale liquor to the Coconut Grove because we voluntarily turned in our liquor license. Yet the city says I've been illegal since August 24th. And that's where I then went to try to find many, many lawyers to take the case. Some wanted huge amounts of money. Another one who Most didn't want to touch it because they're afraid of the politics that be. I finally found somebody who's helping me, and we filed a federal lawsuit on December 3rd, and hopefully, we'll, as Peter's pointed out, we'll get our day in court and be able to point all this stuff out.
It's an awesome story. Peter, I'm sure you have lots to say.
Well, I just actually want to ask Sam a couple of questions. Now, this document that you say shows that you're legal, what exactly is that document?
The one that they said that we had a bug in the bottle and we had to pay a fine and shut down, or the one I had to turn over to the state? There's two documents.
Well, let's just talk about them both, if I could. The one about the bug in the bottle, that just said that they found bugs in your bottles, which I guess is common, and you had to pay a fine or you would be shut down, and I assume you paid the fine.
Yeah. No, you get a choice. You can pay the fine or shut down.
Okay, and paid the fine.
It's really weird. You know, you can either pay the fine or they pick what days you shut down. And then they send someone else to make sure you're not open.
You paid the fine, I assume.
Yeah, we paid the fine of $100.
Okay, so that's an easy one. Now, this other document, what was that other document?
The other document was, what happened was, by the way, the dates, they took the days to shut down. You don't have to pick the days. And they picked the days November 27th, 28th, and 29th of last year. But the city is saying we were legally operating since August of last year. That's why I think that document's important. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm just trying to understand. This document has nothing to do with the bug in the bottle issue, right? This separate document.
Right.
Okay. And this separate document.
The second
exactly
document is when we decided, what happened is, we paid your license. We wanted to get a refund. We knew we were going to shut the bar down. We didn't want to stay. From the very November 6th on, we never opened up again because the city said we were illegal, so we didn't want to do that. You know what I mean? So we just shut the bar down and let the headaches go away. I contacted the Department of Liquor Control, and I said, hey, we're not going to renew this license, we'll get a small refund because the license went from to the end of the month. The license went to was good till January 15th. So we had the documents that the state requires, who has total jurisdiction over liquor, not the city, the state does, to shut the bar down. I had to give this agent, his name is Steve Arnold, nice guy, by the way, I had to give him the license that we had, and he gives me a receipt that he has it. And then he says, and then I signed my name, he signed his name, and he says, Sam, effective now, don't be caught selling liquor in this bar because now you're illegal.
So you believe that document indicates that prior to that date, your establishment was, quote-unquote, had a liquor license, was legal?
That's correct.
Okay. So the document indicates that that was the date that the license got suspended or whatever it is. And that prior to that date, you had a valid liquor license.
That's correct.
All right. Well, that's certainly interesting. Now, this other thing that you said your attorney didn't want to show, what exactly was it that you wanted your attorney to...
Okay, what happened? The day of the hearing in county court, I went down to the liquor store that I'm allowed to, told I have to buy liquor from, and purchased a bottle of liquor wholesale under my license, got a receipt for that, and I brought it into court with me to show.
And you thought that showed what?
That we were operating legally, but we had a valid liquor license.
Right. I don't think that act of buying a bottle wholesale shows that you had a valid liquor license.
Well, you can't, in the state of Ohio, you can't buy one. Only liquor permit holders can pay. I paid, I forgot what I bought. Well, let's say I bought a bottle of Ciroc, okay? I paid $18 for it.
But my point is, the person who sold you the bottle, if they don't check your liquor license or if pardon me?
They do, yes. You have a valid, they check your liquor license.
On the day that you bought that thing, the person behind the counter you bought it from, they, at that moment, they have some ability to check your license, and they did, and they always do that.
Two different ways. You can't buy, wholesale people can't buy behind the counter. You have to go to a special door and go to a special purchasing procedure to buy it. Because there's a difference between retail and wholesale, obviously.
Right, but the person who sold it to you, they do some process where they check your license status at that particular moment when they sell you the bottle.
That's correct. And if you're not licensed, if you're not legal, it'll be in their computer system that says, I have a copy of it. You cannot, this license is no longer valid.
Okay, and you say you have a copy of it, meaning a copy of something saying that you were valid?
Yes.
And that's something other than this suspension we talked about a while ago.
That's correct. And okay. I also have a letter. I also, after I passed in all my paperwork to this agent, Stephen Arnold, we received something in the mail that said, your license is now null and void, and that's it. And effective immediately, your license is null and void. That was December 20th.
It sounds to me like, I mean, there's only two ways to interpret this. One way to interpret this is that, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, or there's some sort of mix-up. In other words, the police think that you don't have a valid permit, and they've made a mistake, and they're enforcing laws against you because they're operating under a belief, which appears to be erroneous. They're operating under a belief that you're not supposed to be operating, and when they show you that little document, they think that that document says you no longer have a license, and so they're basically saying we don't need a warrant because this says you don't have a license. So if you're operating now, you're operating illegally. You're committing a crime. We don't need a warrant for a crime. We only need warrants for suspected crime. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation is that basically you're the subject of a witch hunt in one form or another. And usually when we have these two alternatives, usually it's bureaucratic incompetence or mix-up that causes this. But in your situation, it's possible that, you know, they may be intentionally trying to raid you or shut you down, knowing full well that they don't have that you were a valid establishment. I just don't know enough. It's always harder to prove that than it is just to prove that people made mistakes.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is one. I mean, it bothers me as a citizen, even if it wasn't me, but if it was somebody else, that all this police power, these bureaucracies, that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's going. You know what I mean? That bothers me. That I went to jail illegally out of it. I personally believe I was illegally arrested. You know, spent a day in jail, night in jail. Because of incompetence. But that, and that if it happened to any citizen, it would bother me. That, you know, hey, you know, you got Department of Liquor Control, Department of Public Safety, vice squads and this and that. But, you know, and this is the way they acted. I personally believe I'm the subject of a witch hunt. And more detail comes up.
Sam, I have to ask you. I think I know the answer. I've read the complaint, and I like it. Why don't you name the vice squad people? Yeah, John Doe's 1 through 3, I believe.
I don't know what their names are. If I did, I'd name their names.
That's a common practice in litigation. When you don't know, when you draft a complaint, you typically don't have documents and discovery that you get after you file the lawsuit. So you don't know the names of people who you want to sue, and so what you do is you sue them as does. You sue them as does 1 through 50, and when you learn their names or identities, you amend the complaint. You file a piece of paper, and you say where Doe 1 is actually John Smith. Doe 2 is, Sam Steele or whatever it is. And that way – you don't have to refile the complaint. The complaint you filed before suffices, but you later amend it with this document just to show that you finally ascertained the names of these people.
But Sam, surely you asked, you know, to see, you know, proof of, you know, who the hell these people were.
Well, I'm sure when they show up, I'm sure when they show up in law enforcement vehicles, and they may flash badges. Some of them may have firearms. Some of them may be wearing uniforms. I don't know what the scenario was, but usually, you know, most people really don't ask the cops for ID when they're confronted with them. They just tend to comply.
Oh, I asked for ID. They showed me their badges, their speaking badges, but I forget what their names were. I mean, it was a long time ago.
You don't write that stuff down. You don't whip out your camera and say, "Well, let me take a picture of your badge." I mean, people just don't do that. You know, they may flash a badge in you and they say, "I'm Detective so and so, or Inspector so and so, or Officer so and so," but people oftentimes don't remember that.
Yeah, and that was easy, and I learned that from my doing that stuff, that's exactly what we're doing, you know, and that's what has to happen. But the thing that also bothers me, is along with one, of course, being, illegally arrested and detained, as far as I'm concerned, is I cannot understand for the life of me, again, not just me, I'm sure it's happened to others, is that the city of Youngstown council, they listen to one councilman. The councilman gets up there. He lobbies his fellow brothers and sister councilmen and says, "We have to shut down the Coconut Grove." They don't give me a chance for hearing. They just have a hearing. Don't invite me, our neighbors, our employees, the people we do business with, anybody else. They just shut us down. No, we never had a right to. I mean, it's almost like you're not allowed to have a defense. The plaintiff, you know, the prosecutor wins. There's no defense, and that's it. And that's not the way the system works. I've always believed in due process. I would have had no problem if they would have given us notice about this hearing or hearing that we think happened before and had our right to go down and make our case. I think maybe some of these councilmen and councilwomen would have said, "Man, you bring up some good points, but let's find common ground." But in this case, there was no due process. I never was allowed to confront my accusers about what happened, you know, and why they wanted to shut me down. They paraded me in front of the media. They made it look like in the media that we did have something to do with the murder, which really bothers me, and that we were running a very bad gay bar. And, you know, my name got dragged through the mud of all this. Yeah, and on top of that being, you know, when I was arrested, guys, they paraded me in front of my customers. They made a scene that I was being arrested. My wife was there. My wife's father was arrested by the Nazis, and she's from Holland, okay? So you can imagine how upset she was. She was dragged away by the Nazis. So you can imagine, you know, and that's what I felt like. And that's what anybody, to be paraded like that and be made a laughing stock in the media when it need not be, it's very troublesome to me, and that's why I hope we get our day in court, because there are some legal issues. Absolutely, and Peter, I agree with you. Is it a bureaucratic cluster? You know what? Am I the victim of being? I don't know. But it makes no sense to me that no one from the state, or the state's telling me I'm legal, the city's telling me I'm not legal, yet the city had violated, when I've dealt with the state of Ohio, they're always an agent from the Department of Public Safety, which is the liquor controls police force, there. In my case, never did the city ever have anybody from the Department of Public Safety there as their ally or comfort, you know, or whatnot. And by the way, the only thing in the 13 years of running the bar was the one bug in the bottle. That's the only complaint we ever had. No underage, no drug sales, no prostitution. We weren't involved in any of that stuff, yet other bars have had that up the wazoo. And nothing's happened to them. And so I believe we were a victim of selective enforcement, and it will come out in court. I think it's going to come out in discovery when we get going, because of the nature of how people are very loosey-goosey with their cell phone, their text, and their emails. And blessedly, a new mayor was elected recently who has vowed to clean house down there, and I think that's going to help our cause, too.
Okay.
Well,
really need to wrap this up because everyone's cell phone battery is going to be dying. Yeah, apart from me. Yeah, my phone plugs into the wall. Bill, you've been very quiet. Got any parting thoughts for us?
Yeah, I think Sam's a victim. I think there's, again, I think there's some kind of conspiracy where they're trying to take him out and do something with his property that it's just not right. It's not fair. Nothing sounds like it's right. But again, I believe in a lot of conspiracy theories, so here we go. That's all.
Oh, okay. And Peter.
Well, Sam, I find this story very interesting, and again, I'm really glad that you got to talk about it because it certainly provided a lot more information than I was able to glean from the complaint. And if I can, I'd like to try and help you out with this a little bit more. I'm not sure what I can do.
Peter, you've made my day. I'm going to go drink a glass of wine and celebrate. I sent you some things in the mail. The rest of it that I had, the rest is at my attorney's office. Anything you want, I'll be glad to send me an email and I'll send it to you. I am going to give you the parting thought, though, to tell you that I am a victim. You guys are going to die howling laughter, okay? I owned a rental piece of property across the street from the Coconut Grove, okay? The brick house had seen its better days. We boarded it up and cut the grass, did everything you're supposed to do. Every year you're supposed to register the vacant property to the city of Youngstown with the address where they can get a hold of me, somebody they can call in case something goes wrong. And I understand all that. I paid the $100 fee. We kept it secured and whatnot. Well, and for 5 years I've been negotiating it took us 5 years to find out who the hell had the lien on the property. We finally found the bank. The bank agreed to deed the property to me so I could fix this piece of property up and sell it or maybe, you know, whatever. So in the process of doing that, a friend of mine drives by and says, Sam, they're ripping down your house. So Bill might be on to something. They ripped down my house without giving me notice that they were ripping down my house. My house is now a vacant lot. It's gone.
Wow.
So I think I'm a victim. This happened. And my new lawyer now is like, oh boy, I think the conspiracy is complete now. We have no notification that it's going to tear my house down. And by the way, there's 7,000 structures in the city of Youngstown cited for demolition. 6,900. Mine was the best. The house we kept was incredibly in good condition. Luckily, I have videos of it and pictures. There's houses all around me that are death trapped anybody. So why was I picked? So, Bill, I think you're right about the conspiracy.
There's way too no time to talk about it, but I do believe there is another story involving you, but let's keep that for next week. I really want to thank all of you for being on the program, and I'm going to go once around the table for, well, you know, goodbyes, shall we say. Peter, what do you have to say to wrap this program up?
Well, for Sam's sake, I hope the Cleveland Browns find a way to win next week. And, Sam, you and I will talk before then. Thanks for all the information today. It's very interesting.
Thank you, Peter.
And Bill, sorry, You haven't been very forceful this week. Yeah, this is a tough crowd. Yeah, you got to bust in and make your point.
Well, thank you for putting up into my being quiet and not involved in things that I'm not 100% sure of. But another thing on Ohio is I saw the Ohio State and the Michigan game, and it's the funeral march for Ohio State losing after 24 successful wins was pretty sad for all of those people in Ohio. Have a great week, all.
Okay. Sam.
I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to get the story out and get some more information to Peter, because that's a guy, he's a man who I want on my side at all times. And you, Bill, and you, Simon, could be my foxhole anytime. I hope you feel the same way about me. It's a sad story, but I think it's going to, on many, many occasions, but I think it's going to have a happy ending. And that's what we're looking forward to right now. It's still mind-boggling to me. And when others hear about it, you see the documents, actually, they sit there and go, how the hell did this happen? And I just want, and one of the things we asked for in the complaint was, of course, money, but the city adopt policy that this doesn't happen again. I don't want to see some other push. What happened to this? And then I start asking myself, because I'm that type of person, have they ever done this to somebody else before who didn't have their backbone, the guts, the friends, a few bucks to fight back? And I got to think the answer is probably yes, because the reason these guys did it is because they think they're good. And that's ever since, but everything I'm against, and I know all you gentlemen are too, and I thank you for the opportunity. Peter, I don't think the Browns are ever going to win a game. Either that or you pulled the April Fool's joke on me. Because when I called in, they were up by 12 with a minute to go. Now you're telling me they lost.
They managed to lose in the last 30 seconds.
Okay, gentlemen, I want to say thank you very much for taking part in the program today. And we'll be back again next week. Until then, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy and safe week. Goodbye.